Our gospel reading this morning is from the Gospel of Mark, chapter 4, verses 35 to 41. On that day when evening had come, he said to them, "Let us go across to the other side." And leaving the crowd behind, they took him with them in the boat, just as he was. Other boats were with him. A great windstorm arose, and the waves beat into the boat so that the boat was already swamped. But he was in the stern, asleep, on the cushion. And they woke him and said to him, "Teacher, do you not care that we're perishing?" They're Eastern European disciples. He woke up and rebuked the wind and said to the sea, "Peace, be still." And then the wind ceased and there was a dead calm. And he said to them, "Why are you afraid? Have you still no faith?" And they were filled with awe and said to one another, "Who then is this that even the wind and the sea obey him?" The word of the Lord. Well, I only drowned one time. I was 13 years old, and I was with a friend, and we were cruising through California. We were in the Central Valley, and we came upon the California Aqueduct. And he said, "For a lark, let's just go swimming." So we did. And what we didn't anticipate was that there was a spillway in the aqueduct. And the water spilling over the top like this. And what I didn't know was that there was an undertow just on this side of the spillway. And I got caught in the undertow. And I came up and I realized my normal ways of doing business were not going to help. And then I got pulled down again and I began to tire. And then I became exhausted. And then I panicked. And I don't know if you've had an experience like that. I came up, and each time I surfaced, I could see people lining up on the side of the aqueduct, watching me drown. I know what the disciples were feeling in that boat. I know that feeling. Everything is happening so quickly. It is all completely out of control. Will we have the strength to get through the night? You're in the grip of forces that are bigger than you are, and you are growing tired and then exhausted and then panicky. Maybe it is that your kids are chaotic. Maybe it is that there's dis-ease born from the topsy-turvy way the world seems to be going. I thought of that nuclear bomb threat in Hawaii a week ago, 10 days ago. What struck me about that threat was not so much that there was the threat or the error, but that when it happened, people believed it. We find ourselves in a world that seems to be growing increasingly dangerous. We may be concerned about the growing homeless population or about global warming. Or perhaps you or someone you love is facing an incurable illness. Like my wife, this last 3 years has been treated for a form of cancer called multiple myeloma. She's now in remission. But there were times when we didn't know that would be the outcome, and we went through some very dark nights. I know what it feels like to be the disciples in the boat, and I think all of you do too. Let's set the scene. It's late in the day. Excuse me. The storm has come up. This is quite common in the Galilee. The name of the lake in Hebrew is Kinneret, which means harp. So I brought a map. It's narrow at the bottom and wide at the top, like a harp. It's 13 miles from north to south and 8 miles across. It takes several hours to cross in a small boat. Right along this side, there is a mountain called the Arbel. It's a big bluff, and when the wind comes up in the afternoon, it strafes into this area, and it's focused by the Arbel so that it goes down into the plain of Gennesaret and strafes the top part of the lake. The top part of the lake, by the way, is the part that's where the fishing is. This is where the population is, and that's because the southern part is very, very deep and the water is extremely cold, and in the top part there are 7 hot water springs that feed warm water into the lake, and so the fish prefer it up there. So they swim up, and not a good choice for them, but they didn't know. But this happens mostly in the late afternoon. So Mark has given us a picture of a storm in the late afternoon. Jesus and his disciples are in a small boat. In 1986, the Israeli government began using the Sea of Galilee as a national reservoir, and they would drain off the water and use it to water the farms. When they did that, the sea level dropped, and people began going out with Geiger counters, and a man was out with a Geiger counter, and he found a small boat. It's called the Galilee boat. Some of you have seen it. How many of you have seen the Galilee boat? This is what it looks like. These are its dimensions. It's 26 feet long. This is the prow, so. It's 7.5 feet wide, and it's 4.5 feet deep, just like that. 13 men in a boat this size. The men are actually a little bit smaller than, we have to make an adjustment for their size because the average height of an adult male is about 5'10", 9 or 10. We know this from skeletons in excavations of graveyards. The most important thing about the boat is that it has no keel. If they'd had a keel, they couldn't beach the boat in order to offload their catch. But the fact that it has no keel also means that it's easily overturned in the water. So this means that the disciples are doing two things. They are bailing water, and they're trying to keep the boat headed into the waves. It's a dire situation, and Jesus is in that part of the boat where the kick is the worst. He's in the stern. And the boat is going like this in the water. So he's at the place where it is most violent, up here. And here is where he sleeps. The disciples are frantically working the front of the boat, trying to keep it from turning into the trough and being overturned and keep it from being swamped. And they're in the middle of the lake, and they're running out of energy, and they're exhausted, and they're frightened, and they wake Jesus up. And they say, "Master, do you not care if we're perishing?" Why do they ask this? It's quite common to think they ask this question because they want him to still the storm. But that's not so. We know that's not so because of the way the story ends. At the very end, the last verse in the story says, "They were filled with awe and said to one another, 'Who then is this that even the wind and sea obey him?' They were startled, when he stilled the storm. They didn't know he knew how to do that. So I think they were trying to get him to bail water. You know. He has never done this before. Not only are they startled, they're outright shocked. The text says they were filled with awe. But I think the Greek is just a little stronger than that. The word translated awe here is phobos. Phobos is the word from which we get the word phobia. And the word appears twice in the same phrase. It says, ephobethesan phobon megan. They were filled with a massive fear. A mega fear. They're terrified. They are more afraid of the peace in the boat than they are the storm in the sea. At this moment, Jesus turns out to be someone they completely misunderstood. This fear that they have, this terror that they have, I think Mark's original readers would have felt it as well. The Gospel of Mark appears to have been written sometime in the latter half of the 60s, maybe as late as 70 or 71. In 64, the city of Rome was destroyed by a fire. There were 14 districts in the city. 10 of the districts were consumed completely. Nero was blamed. The popular gossip blamed Nero, and he blamed the Christians. And so he set about to persecute the Christians, to punish them for the fire. Tradition has it that Peter and Paul both perished in this persecution. Peter by being crucified upside down, Paul by being beheaded. The church is in dismay. Mark knows this when he writes the story, and when he tells the story about the disciples in the boat being terrified, the original reader he wrote for would have understood that completely from his or her own experience. And Mark has structured his story in such a way that he addresses this fear in the part of the reader. The stilling of the storm comes immediately after the parables discourse in chapter 4. If you read the parables discourse carefully, something comes out. The point is people are falling away. The cares of the world, the delight in riches, the desire for other things has entered in and choked the word. Remember that? But the point of the parable is still there's a bumper crop. God succeeds. God succeeds despite everything to the contrary. So this message, first to Mark's readers, also to us, has acquired a universal application in the life of the church. There's a larger sense in which this image of the ship has become a parable of the church. These are symbols from all over in the history of the church. The word oikoumene here means something like the whole world, so that you see the church as salvation from the trouble of that's out in the world at large. This is the place where we together are safe. What's the phrase? Somos el barco. There's another image. This one's a little more straightforward. I like this image particularly because I think I see Tiger Woods there on the right. You know, do you see him? And look down just on Jesus' right hand down, first face you see, that's Eileen Burdick, I think. So you're a biblical character now, Eileen. Four things stand out in the way Mark tells this story. The first is that there are hints of the demonic in this story. My teacher, Howard Key, treats this story as an exorcism. The reason for that, in part, is because in the ancient world, people had a kind of love-hate relation with the sea. It was a place where they could gather food, but it was also a place of great danger. It was unpredictable. And some of them accounted for that unpredictable quality by coming to the belief that the sea was the habitation of demons. I'm not quite there with Dr. Key. Instead, I think there's a subtle overcoat of the demonic. It's not stated flat out, but it's hinted in the way the story is told. It's a little bit like when people harmonize and there's the tonalities blend together, and this is the tonality of the demonic in this story. Not obvious, but hinted in the way the story is told. If that's possible, it would cut off two standard misreadings of the story. The first is that there's the issue between good and evil is about getting the language right. Something's evil until we can find a way to restate it in positive terms, and then it's no longer evil. My mom was good at this. I love my mom. She was a woman of deep faith. She's a tiny little woman, but she had a towering faith. But she would smash her thumb with a hammer and then say, "Praise the Lord." which didn't quite sing for me. But the possibility of the demonic in the story prevents us from saying, "Oh, look, if we get the language right, it'll all turn out good." This is the difference between heaven and hell in the story. And still, Jesus sleeps. The second misreading is that the trouble may have been brought on by God. I don't know if you've ever had some turmoil in your life, some distress, and you have a secret belief, maybe in the back of your mind, maybe God is punishing me for something that I did wrong, or punishing my wife, or God is teaching me a hard lesson here, and he seems so cruel. But Mark's overcoat of the demonic prevents us from attributing the storm to the divine, from blaming God for the trouble. The second thing to notice in the story is that Jesus is asleep. This is absolutely astonishing. It is not usual in a miracle story for the miracle worker to enter the story asleep. Because it's unusual in a miracle, it will pop for the reader. The reader will hear it and go, "Oh," you'll pay closer attention to that which stands out. And not only is it unusual and pop in that way, but Mark actually repeats it here in the story. In verse 38, he says, "He was in the stern asleep on the cushion, and they woke him and said to him, 'Teacher, do you not care that we're perishing?' And he woke and said to the sea, 'Peace, be still.'" He was asleep. They woke him. He woke. Turns out that the sleep provides a kind of interpretive key to the overall structure of the story. Its import is that even during an attack that threatens everything, that might even be demonic, Jesus can sleep. He's not afraid. In fact, in verse 40, he says to them, "Why are you afraid? Why are you afraid? Have you no faith?" The story is telling us that we too are invited to the place where our faith is so strong that we too can sleep in the presence of the worst that we can imagine. The third thing to note about the story is that the sequence involves a reversal. We're all so familiar with this story that it's hard for us to hear it through fresh ears. But imagine we had never heard it before. Nothing in the beginning of the story signals us about the way it's going to turn out. The conclusion isn't obvious from the start. It sneaks up on the reader. The critical clue here is that the sleep changes meaning. At first, the reader shares the disciples' perception of Jesus. He's in the rear of the boat. He's asleep. He's probably exhausted. This comes at the end of a long day of teaching. He's so exhausted. And they wake him up, and he silences the wind, and he stills the water, and he says, "Why are you afraid?" It turns out he's not sleeping because he's exhausted. He's sleeping because he's unafraid. He's confident. It's like Mark has placed the reader on a large, lazy Susan and turned the thing 180 degrees in the middle of the story. And then notice finally that the story closes with an unanswered question. This is also unusual. It's unusual for any story to end with an unanswered question. It prompts the reader to answer the question that's been left sort of dangling there. But it's also unusual for a miracle story to end with an unanswered question. Usually the miracle stories end with something called an acclamation. And that's when the people who are there, who see the miracle, go, "Wow, we never saw anything such as this." Or, "At once his fame spread everywhere throughout the surrounding region of Galilee." This story ends with the disciples' puzzlement. Who is this that even the winds and the sea obey him? The disciples do not yet know the answer to that question. Jesus is more and other than they believe at this moment. He's the one who can still the storm. What's interesting to me is that the reader of the Gospel of Mark does know the answer to that question. The reader of the Gospel of Mark has heard the story read in a continuous flow. All the evidence suggests that Mark was designed to be read in a single evening. Most of the readers are illiterate, so there would have been an assigned lector who would have practiced and then would read in an evening. So it's almost like going to the theater and hearing the story read out. So the reader has heard the beginning of the gospel, first line, the beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. But the disciples never heard that. The reader has heard the voice that comes from the clouds during the baptism. In the Gospel of Mark, the voice says, "Thou art my beloved Son," and there's no indication that anybody else in the along the edge of the water has understood that voice or heard or understood that voice. The demon in the synagogue in Capernaum in chapter 1 calls out Jesus' name, but nobody in the synagogue recognizes that they've understood that voice. So the people inside the story don't know who Jesus is fully, but the reader does. So when they ask the question, the reader is equipped to bring an answer. He's Jesus. He's Christ. He's Son of God. Mark has also reinforced this by making a literary allusion to this psalm that Gordon read for us earlier. Psalm 107. They saw the wonderful things that the Lord did there. He spoke, and a wind started. A storm lifted up the sea. The sailors went up to the sky and then down to the deep places. The danger made them afraid. It was not possible to stand up, so they fell over like drunks. They did not know what to do, and they prayed to the Lord in their trouble, and he saved them from the danger they were in. He stopped the noise and the storm of the storm and made the sea become quiet. So the story takes us from one place and leads us to a different place. It takes us from a place of confusion and panic and exhaustion, and it leads us to a place of stillness and confidence. I need to hear this story in my own life sometimes. We all do. There are moments in my life when I'm afraid, terribly afraid of uncertain circumstances. Sometimes the assault can be difficult and all of our resources are exhausted. Maybe we've lost our job. Maybe we've begun to deal with memories from some childhood trauma that threatens to take down our sense of who we are. Or maybe we're desperate because the world we're living in is so filled with trouble. And we work hard to overcome. And we become exhausted. We're tired of bailing water. We're trying to keep the boat from swamping or turning into the trough of the sea. And it seems to us that God is absent or asleep or unavailable. How many times have you or I cried out in the night, God, don't you care that I'm perishing here? And at times like this, we need to hear the words of this story. Even in the worst of times, God is still in control. Notice verse 39. He woke and rebuked the wind and said to the sea, peace, be still. And the wind ceased, and there was a great calm. So let me take you back to the aqueduct. Here I was, exhausted, panicking. I came up for what must have felt like the last time, and someone on the side of the aqueduct called out to me, go limp. And I relaxed, and I was washed over the spillway and into shallow water. It turns out that my panic itself was the very thing that was keeping me locked in the trouble. Carl's going to sing for us.